You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Joe.
Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
Not bad. Stormy DC day.
Is it storming in DC?
It's about to.
Huh. Well, good.
Both on a spiritual plane, but also meteorologically.
Ah, and you can sense both of these things. I guess you sense the spiritual storm within, or is that also something that is pervading the DC environment?
Yeah, the thunderclaps are ominous in the original sense.
Okay. Well, let me introduce this. So I'm Robert Wright, publisher of Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You are Joe Allen, author of Dark Aeon, A-E-O-N, Transhumanism and the War Against Humanity. You're also tech editor at Steve Bannon's War Room podcast. In fact, people who are watching us on YouTube and not listening to the audio podcast version can see behind you the familiar, to some of us at least, who have watched the show, War Room logo. This is a first for us. First time we've seen that logo. First time I can say live from the War Room studio or whatever. And I'm really looking forward to this conversation for a couple of reasons. One is that it turns out you're familiar with my work. You've actually read one or two of my books. And but I will say, in my defense, I did not know that when I asked you on the podcast.
You weren't asking for the plug, but I got to say, yeah, The Moral Animal had a very deep impact on my way of thinking very, very early on in my life. And The Evolution of God also really fleshed out a lot of the study I did on cultural evolution. So thank you very much and honored to be here. And if I could say, if I can speak for Professor David Howell, retired from Pellissippi State, actually, Community College, we both thank you very much. But that's the last fanboying you're going to get from me.
Oh, it's gonna get harder, it sounds like. Now, and then you did graduate work in theology or something, or?
Yeah, it's the scientific study of religion is kind of the overarching field. It was evolutionary and cognitive science as it applies to religion. So some of the ideas, Ara Noren Zion's Big Gods was very formative, although I disagree on a very deep level with the philosophical position he's coming from. I think that sort of framing is extremely helpful for understanding religion. So yeah, scientific study of religion, altruism was what I concentrated on.
And you studied at Boston University, or do I have that right?
Yeah, that's right. That's Boston
right.
University.
That was where you did your graduate work. Okay, yeah. So I'm really looking forward to this. I've told people one reason I am. But the other is that, you know, I've long thought that it would make sense for there to be within the MAGA coalition a certain amount of skepticism of AI, if not pushback against it. And yet, I would say Donald Trump is kind of a de facto accelerationist in terms of the effects of his policies. And to some extent, the way he talks, his recent kind of AI plan, I forget what they called it, that was released a couple weeks ago. You know, there's a little bit of recalibration there. But so far, the practical effect, I think, of his policies is to be very, kind of accelerationist. J.D. Vance, I would say, talks pretty much the same talk. He, too, I think, has gotten a little more careful over the last year or so, maybe, and is starting to trim his sails a little. But by and large, there's been a lot of boosterism about AI. And again, I would have expected almost the opposite from within the coalition. And now you, on the other hand, have indeed expressed skepticism, if not flat out pushback, toward AI. And that's one reason I'm looking forward to this. Why don't we, and I should say, you're very well versed, not just in the AI like that's happening now, but in the broader technological vision of some of the AI enthusiasts in Silicon Valley, like Peter Thiel, kind of transhumanists, and various other varieties of hardcore kind of techno-optimists, I guess you might say.
I would say that at least right now, at this stage, those ideas are probably the most important element of all of this, the most impactful element.
Yeah.
And the reason I say that, just, you know, the worldview or worldviews that are coming alongside artificial intelligence, I think are having a deeper impact than the technology itself. That may change and change soon. But at the moment, the impact that these ideas are having on the public and also the motivation, assuming that these people are telling the truth about their motives, the motivation, I think, should really be what stuns people. And that's primarily what I'm opposed to, although I have no use for AI whatsoever. You know, I'm a writer, so I don't consider myself to be anything but a writer. And using AI for anything to do with writing is forbidden to me.
You know, I want to get back to what you just said about the larger worldview that's kind of propelling this, in your view, from Silicon Valley. But I kind of think, don't you think, in the coming years, there will be large groups of people who talk kind of the way you're talking now, and it becomes almost like a neo-Amish thing where, I mean, don't you think people will form communities where they want to wall themselves off from the AI, or do you not
yeah.
think that?
Yeah, that's happening now, and I'm counting on it happening at a large scale. It may not be that America as a whole or any nation or civilization as a whole goes full Amish, and if they do, in the presence of other nations with advanced technology, they can assume that every aspect of their life will be at the mercy of the more powerful nation. So I think that there's going to be a very dramatic diversification of ways of life in the coming decades.
Yeah. So let's talk about the worldview that you see as kind of surrounding and to some extent, I guess, propelling the enthusiasm for AI in Silicon Valley. What is the worldview and what bothers you about it?
I think I've been talking with a lot of people about this. How do you describe that worldview? How do you label it? When I started at the War Room, Steve Bannon brought me on as the first a contributor, but very soon as the transhumanism editor. So at that time, especially with the pandemic and the response to the pandemic and everything out of that, we were having a lot more people on to talk about this. And now we've begun to, again, for a lot of it was just me. I was editing myself. But yeah, transhumanism at that time made a lot of sense because it does serve pretty well as an overarching label for that techno-optimist impulse. The way Max Moore defined it very succinctly, and of course Max Moore is the reason we use the word transhumanism, is the use of science and technology to push human beings beyond normal biological limits. And quite simply, I think that's the motive and the aim of everyone from Elon Musk, Sam Altman, Larry Page, Demis Hassabis, on and on and on, Mark Zuckerberg, Peter Thiel. They come out, each one of them has their own flavor of it, but they all exhibit it. On the other hand, there's transhumanism describes a very specific intellectual movement of the late 80s, or, you know, through the 90s and early 2000s. Max Moore, Ben Goertzel, all these people around that, Hugo de Garis, Nick Bostrom, even Eliezer Yudkowsky, they're all very specific, and I think that it becomes confusing. One reason I'm so reluctant to use transhumanism now as a catch-all is just because I've gotten to know Max Moore a bit, and I can see why, aside from just territorialism, he would be so intent on keeping his term away from something like, say, the World Economic Forum with its kind of globalist socialist leanings. You also have like technocracy. And I think technocracy, that's now become quite fashionable. You always hear people who are opposed to a tech policy or a technology or some sort of tech oligarch. They're like, these are technocrats. They're bringing in the technocracy. You hear this very fashionable now. It's kind of funny because it's as if they just learned the word, and many of them they have. But, you know, most of what I know about technocracy, the original technocracy movement and its survival, comes from a man, Patrick Wood. And he still thinks that that's the predominant strain that we see in the tech companies, that the ideas that were forged in the Depression era, Columbia University and all that, with Technocracy Inc., that's the dominant thing. I disagree for the same reasons I disagree with transhumanism. So maybe a friend of mine said maybe vulture capitalism and vulture capitalists is the most apt phrase. Maybe we can go with that.
Okay, so there's a lot there. Let me, first of all, just in case there are listeners who aren't familiar with the word transhumanism, I guess among the people you initially named in connection with it, I guess two examples of transhumanism would be, on the one hand, Elon's Neuralink chips, right? Especially when they are explicitly aimed at enhancing human potential and not just remedying, for example, he's put one in the brain of a guy who was, I think, paralyzed to allow him to move mouse cursor on the screen with his mind.
10. I think they're up to 10 patients now.
Mm-hmm. So, but in any event, there are certainly forms of the Neuralink that would be clearly supplementing human capability. That would be kind of classic transhumanism. And I think Peter Thiel has a near obsession with immortality. Maybe near obsession is putting it too strongly, but I assume that too, in your view, at least certain kinds of interventions aimed at extending human longevity, that would be transhumanism too.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so, and then I wanted to ask about one thing that I'm not sure I got when you said, I think his name is Max Moore, would be uncomfortable about some kind of connection of the terminology to the World Economic Forum. I didn't catch that. Mm. What did you mean by that?
Well, a lot of the, again, fashionable use of the word technology. And when I say fashionable, I mean among people who are opposed to these technologies or the corporations or governments employing them. Transhumanism has become a kind of a go-to, right? I'm not saying that we started that trend. We really didn't at the War Room. It goes back a long way. It goes back to Fukuyama, mm-hmm. right? And maybe even before that. But,
well, you know, it's funny. I heard you say on your podcast, I forget what the phrase was. So you have this, you're not updating it regularly now, but it's the Omega Point podcast. Mm-hmm. You have 10 or 12 podcasts in a row. And I thought you said that Teilhard de Chardin, somebody we're both familiar with, French paleontologist, theologian, mystic, poet, whatever, who died in the 1950s. I thought you said you didn't say he coined the term, but you said he kind of coined it or something. But
yeah, he was among the earliest. There's a Russian who, and I can't remember his name off the top of my head, who may have preceded him, but it's often attributed to
the guy who did cosmism, the cosmism thing.
But he was a cosmist. He was later than Fyodor Fedorov. Yes.
Okay.
I believe that, yes. He may be the first to use transhumanism. It didn't take off. And then you had Deschardins did, he used it in an essay. I don't remember what the title is. In the 50s, though, and he was discussing, he kind of saw it as going beyond the human, transhuman, going beyond the human by seeking liberty, equality, and fraternity, right? And mm-hmm. it did, you know, it's one use, and it kind of went away. For his impact has mainly been concepts like the noosphere, Omega Point, all of these sorts of things. But then Julian Huxley, who is a good friend of his, in 1956 mm-hmm. delivered the lecture entitled Transhumanism. And it was then recorded in a book, a collection of his essays called New Bottles for Old Wine. And
I have the book.
Yeah. And so that's, you know, many people attribute it to Huxley, but Deschardin undoubtedly said it first. And Max Moore arrived at it independently, he tells me, and that it was kind of later on he discovered previous uses of it. But without a doubt, we would not be using the term at all were it not for Max Moore. And when how I met him and became acquainted with him was he reached out, we communicated a bit, and then I debated he and Moore, his wife, Natasha Vita Moore, with a kind of more moderate transhumanist, Nell Watson, who is a very prominent person at IEEE. And their opposition is that Max Moore and Natasha Vita Moore are very much libertarians, you might say. I mean, in fact, very much libertarians. And they are in no way kind of, it's certainly not Max Moore, but woke or socialist or globalist. And so the World Economic Forum, I guess I've taken too long of a turn here. The World Economic Forum's impact.
I think I distracted you actually by getting you onto Teilhard, but go ahead.
The World Economic Forum really came into public focus because of the pandemic. I was vaguely aware of them before 2020, but it really, I don't think much of anybody was talking about the World Economic Forum very much outside of like the critiques like Davos Man and things like that. But after that, you know, they really were a hub for a lot of the policies that were put in place during the pandemic, and the most draconian, oppressive policies you will find had maybe not their origin at the World Economic Forum, but they were a hub for the dissemination of it. So even if you look at things like Event 201 and many other examples that I could list, these are clear indications of how deep of an impact the World Economic Forum had in partnership with like Bill Gates and the Gates Foundation and Johns Hopkins. So Klaus Schwab, then the chairman, who has now been ousted because he wasn't sufficiently woke, he got canceled, which is really funny. Klaus Schwab
was
in
that,
2000...
Was that a Me Too issue or what? You don't have to go into it, but...
He apparently allowed a lot of Me Too-ish things to happen. You know, you get a lot of rich people in Switzerland. What do you expect? But and also, apparently, there were some N-bombs dropped here and there that he was not dropping, but he was responsible for. And I imagine just a lot of the young people probably had it with his crap. But so, yeah, he's ousted. But anyway, he in 2016, 15 really, but for the big publication, he published the book in partnership with a co-author, The Fourth Industrial Revolution. And if you look at the Fourth Industrial Revolution that he's describing, he describes it as the convergence of the physical, digital, and biological worlds. He's alternatively described it as the fusion of our physical, digital, and biological selves and identities. That is, in essence, the kind of vibe of transhumanism. And as you go through the book and his arguments, it is undoubtedly a transhumanist point of view. And if you look at the appendix, which is quite long, it's almost a third of the book, I think it's called Deep Shifts. And this is really being sourced from a lot of people in major corporations. I think it's like executives and government officials, 100 or so of them. And it's kind of looking at what people in 2016 believed would be the future of humanity. Everything from artificial intelligence making decisions to brain implants to genetic engineering, designer babies, autonomous vehicles, robots, all this sort of stuff. So there is a good reason that the World Economic Forum got hit with the transhumanism label. And even like one of the real prominent transhumanists, early transhumanists, Hugo de Garis, he describes going to World Economic Forum gatherings some 25 years ago. So there's a reason for it. But for Max Moore and Natasha Vita Moore, they're the originators of it, right? You can't copyright something like that. But they just want, I feel like for them, they want to distinguish themselves completely from the World Economic Forum, people like Yuval Noah Harari. And they also want to distinguish themselves completely from people like Ray Kurzweil and the singularitarians. You know, they don't believe a singularity is imminent. They're actually quite skeptical of the technologies that we have right now.
Yeah, and to further drive home how complicated this is, Harari himself is something of an AI skeptic and a little bit of a doomer, I think.
If I can just say on that note, Harari, on the offhand chance he's listening right now, he owes me gold. He owes me something because I've spent an inordinate amount of time and energy not defending him, but clarifying his position, because he's become the scapegoat for everything that we would call transhumanism. And it's absurd because he is so techno-negative.
Now he is, yeah. It's interesting.
Oh, really always has been.
Would you say he has been? I haven't read Sapiens, but I assumed it wasn't techno-negative. Or maybe...
A little less so, yeah. But by the time you get to Homo Deus, I mean, it's intentionally mm-hmm. dark, you know?
Yeah. It's funny, because he was a darling of Silicon Valley for a while, and most people in Silicon Valley are not techno-negative. So, okay, so I want to get back to this, the kind of, you know, this particular context for some support for AI, this, you know, transhumanists and, you know, accelerationist, hardcore techno-optimists. But first, let's touch briefly on this question of kind of MAGA and AI. My kind of instinct about this was, you know, for starters, I think of MAGA as being, you know, maybe this is too fancy a way to put it, but, you know, having a strand of Burkean conservatism in it. You know, mm-hmm. Edmund Burke, he said, you know, conservatism involves conserving, right? Like you have a cultural heritage. He probably didn't use the term evolve, but you might say it's evolved in accordance with people's judgments about what works and what doesn't work and what values make sense and what values don't, and what is wise guidance to give your children and what isn't wise guidance to give your children, and so on. So we shouldn't carelessly abandon parts of the culture we inherit. And so we should be suspicious of people who want to change things rapidly, right? Like that is a tradition in conservatism, is plainly at odds with the libertarian strand of conservatism, so much so that you might ask whether they should even both be encompassed by the same word, like whether one of them should find a word other than conservatism. And I think I know which side you'd want to be if only one of you got the term conservatism. So that was my instinct. And then, you know, kind of philosophy aside, I mean, I think of MAGA as just when you look at what they talk about and many of the things Trump said that got him elected, has a very Burkean flavor to it. And if you just, aside from that, look at the likely fairly early impacts of AI, such as raising new questions about your children's relationship to technology. I mean, social media was complicated enough. This is going to be significantly weirder, right? If your kids start, having not just friends and counselors, although that can go awry too, but, you know, actual romantic partners and so on, who
groomers.
Are AI. Yeah. Well, okay. Now I'll leave that to you. But yeah, no. I mean, look, that's the thing. I mean, bad actors can use this stuff in so many ways because, and again, I'm not like anti AI. I'm just trying to sound a cautionary note. I'm anti accelerationist. And because I think we should take a good look and try to be as careful as we can. But yeah, no, groomers is a good example because this stuff is going. It already has considerable persuasive power. They've shown that in studies. It's good at convincing people of things. It's gonna get better, and there are more and more anecdotes about how it can go awry. So yeah, people can use it to groom. They can use it to start religious cults that are scams. Mm-hmm. There's just a ton of stuff you can do that is going to, I think, have a dislocating effect on lots of parts of society. We haven't even talked about the impact on jobs, right? So it just seemed to me that, although I understand like the libertarians are going to be enthusiastic about AI kind of by their nature, I didn't used to. I guess MAGA's always had a little bit of a libertarian. I don't know. You tell me. I've talked long enough. You tell me. You sort this stuff out. Like, what would you expect MAGA's attitude, not towards transhumanism, to be? We'll get back to that. But just like AI over the next couple of years. Yeah. And what are you seeing on the ground in MAGA land?
Well, you know, Bob, I'm in the middle of what's been about a 7 or 8 month attempt at trying to get my head wrapped around exactly that. Been traveling a lot. I've been talking to a lot of different people and making a lot of connections that have opened my eyes to quite a few things. But I still can only offer you a preliminary report. What I see and have seen over, say, the past 5 years is there is a suspicion, a deep suspicion, an instinctive suspicion of these technologies that, if it were articulated philosophically, would be very Burkean. But I think it is more instinctive. It's an ick factor. It was really reinforced during the pandemic because you had a lot of different things converging all at once. Going back to Klaus Schwab, and one reason he is sort of this demonic boogeyman for the right is his book, The Great Reset, which is just a very cynical, crass take on the pandemic. Those who believe he's behind the one world cabal to enslave all humanity would say that it's the manifesto for them, but I don't really see it that way at all. Anyway, you had mass digitization that came out of the pandemic. You lock people down, you tell people not to be near each other, you tell people to turn to digital devices for interaction. You have this massive explosion of the Zoom call culture, which we are now using right now. And then coupled with that was the surveillance and enforcement aspect of the pandemic. So it wasn't that big in America. You had some anecdotes, say in New Jersey, where they were flying drones around and even having drones go around and order people to remain distant from each other. Other countries were much, much harsher. China, obviously Singapore, UK. But this technological, it was very clear during the pandemic that this technological oppression was going to be, it seemed at the time, maybe going to be this all-encompassing dystopia, although that's been rolled back quite a bit. But it was just very clear to a lot of people that the fears of total technological control that really started bubbling up in the 80s and 90s, and you saw it with Kaczynski and the whole Unabomber cult, certainly after 9/11, that this notion, and after the Edward Snowden revelations, this notion that there is the system of mass surveillance, social control, and it was coupled in the pandemic with the biological element. So I think most people assumed, and quite rightly, that the COVID-19 virus was the result, or at least that strain was the result of tinkering with bioengineering in Wuhan. And so you had that element, right? And that goes back, that skepticism of the whole practice goes back really to the 60s. But it came to the forefront of the consciousness, right? And then you had the vaccine. And the vaccine was this experimental mRNA platform. The more we started looking into Moderna, and you see their philosophical framework of the human body as an operating system, as DNA as computer code, injections of either vaccines or other sorts of genetic tinkering being a software update for the body, this sort of thing. So the reason that I think a lot of conservatives, MAGA, to put a brief frame around this, the reason MAGA is so flipped out about the ideas of transhumanism and technocracy, World Economic Forum, and all of that, and AI, is instinctive, but there are very good reasons, right? We saw what would happen, the first preview, what would happen if techno-obsessed people, techno-fetishists, took over society. Now, you might then ask, well, how is it that Trump partnered with the world's wealthiest transhumanist, Elon Musk, and then proceeded to boost AI throughout his campaign? People call him a Trojan horse for AI. it would be like a Trojan horse where the Greeks were riding on top of the horse into an open gate. There was no subterfuge there at all. It's what he said the entire time. I railed against it the entire time. I voted for him. And I think that it was, he's better than Harris, but undoubtedly that aspect I am completely opposed to. And then day two of his administration, he comes out he trots out Sam Altman, Masayoshi Son, and Larry Ellison to announce the Stargate project, which already has these strange sort of mystical and psychic associations. What you saw then, I think that this is what's playing out, right? A lot of the MAGA coalition, I would say the vast majority of the MAGA coalition would be considered very much anti-technology, or at least anti-radical technology and radical human augmentation and all of that. The vast majority, for religious reasons, for instinctive reasons, all of that. But then once Trump started going hard on boosting AI, you saw a breakaway contingent, right? You already had the techno-optimists there, the tech bros or the tech right. They were already there, but they just gained a lot of traction because of Trump's endorsement. And so now you have a lot of people, the same people who 4 years ago, 3 years ago, 2 years ago, would have said that AI is the manifestation of the Antichrist. They're now saying, oh, you know, it's actually a really useful tool. Or they're like, oh, it's going to happen anyway, so somebody's got to be ahead of it, and all of this sort of stuff. I think the long and short of it is that people are very fickle, and they will go towards whatever shiny, many of them will go towards whatever shiny object is dangled in front of them. So, yeah, there is, though, that's not to say that
now,
even
is,
most...
Now, is this at the more like at the MAGA elite level you're talking about? Where...
No. No, on the
so a number at the grassroots, you mean Trump has led people at the grassroots to be more favorably inclined toward AI, or at least more open-minded about it and less opposed to it or skeptical of it?
Yeah, I think absolutely. People look to those kinds of social signals, and it has a deep impact. Now, that's not to say I don't have any kind of statistical evidence, so I don't want to present it that way. But my sense is actually that the majority of MAGA is extremely uncomfortable, to say the least, and maybe opposed to what's happening with the handing the keys to the kingdom over to these tech oligarchs. And the war room has been a steady voice in this. Steve has been consistent and relentless on this. He was a little bit diplomatic with Elon Musk for like a very brief period of time, just going into and after the election, but he can't really contain himself, and he immediately began beating Elon Musk.
That's something he has in common with Elon Musk, if it's true.
Yeah. So yeah, if I could speak, I'm not trying to speak for MAGA at all, but if I can give you my sense of it, is that most are uncomfortable with it. But a lot more of, you know, you'd mentioned the leadership, the kind of elite, the people, the moneyed interests, the political powers and the corporate powers that have thrown their weight behind MAGA. I think that you would see kind of a different shift there. I think a lot more of the influencers, right, the people who are influencing opinion or determining policy, whether it be corporate or governmental, they are much more inclined towards techno-optimism and much more comfortable with David Sachs and Mark Andreessen and Peter Thiel and Alex Karp and people like that coming in and maybe not running the show, but having tremendous power. I mean, look at what's happening with Palantir. It's crazy.
Yeah, I'm tempted to just spend the rest of the time talking about Alex Karp because he strikes me as such a, I guess the polite term would be fascinating figure. I guess, well, let me quickly ask Palantir. I assume that you would think like true MAGA is skeptical of Palantir, not just because of the techno, you know, accelerationism or whatever, but because true MAGA is said to have a certain skepticism about military intervention, and Palantir is all about championing. They're pretty the bigger the Pentagon budget gets, the happier they are, I would just say.
Yeah, and again, it reflects that split. It's a complicated split, but all the you call them heel draggers or call them enlightened minds, I would be more inclined towards the latter. But those in the MAGA coalition who are very opposed to this, they see Palantir really as a symbol for all of it now. And I think in some ways, rightly so, in some ways not. Palantir has been around for 22 years. A lot of people have only just discovered them and made it their mission to, destroy them or whatever. That's not going to happen. And even if it did happen, you've got so many other companies that are in the same business that they would just simply be replaced. Maybe they'd be less effective, but they are outsized. I mean, vastly outperforming both financially and technologically their competitors at the moment. So they're really important. Plus, the philosophical angle of Alex Karp and Peter Thiel adds a different element to it. And also, like Palmer Luckey, who isn't a Palantir guy, but he's very Palantir adjacent.
Well, and Daryl is the big up-and-coming Silicon Valley Pentagon, Pentagon contractor. And that's his thing. He did Oculus and so on before that.
I think, too, with what is one of their primary roles? And that is to identify undesirables and ensure that they're killed or imprisoned. I mean, that's their job, right? They do other things, right? They'll handle corporate databases and things like this. But from the beginning, it was a CIA-connected security agency. And
Palantir, you're saying, was?
Yeah, they were founded 2003, 2 years after 9/11. That was Thiel, Karp, a couple of others. And the goal was to help sift through all of that surveillance data. You know, one of the big things in the aftermath of 9/11, it was basically announced, hey, we've had this sort of nascent secure or surveillance state that we've been building on the back of the internet this whole time. And now we're just letting you know, don't step out of line or you get Guantanamo'd. But one of the problems that they had was that there's all this data, and now it's like so much more massive, but there's all this data that they couldn't really sift through. There's the big data center in Utah goes back a long way, but just like, well, what do you do with all that data? How do you flag it? One of the things that Palantir does is help make sense of that data. And by make sense of it, I mean, who is an undesirable, who's not, who's a target, who's a valid target, and who's not, either because for crime, immigration, or military. And we all know that if you build a death machine like that, if you're in control of it, then that makes you the monster. And if you lose control of it, that means you created a monster and basically it got turned against you. So, yeah, there's a huge skepticism towards Palantir, and rightfully so. I think that it's a good to keep in mind that they are part of this, you know, huge network of people with the same interests and goals, but it's a huge problem. And philosophically, I got to say, like Peter Thiel, of all the kind of transhumanist oligarchs, if you want to call them that, Peter Thiel is the most complicated, the most interesting, probably oddly enough, as weird as he is, maybe I'm as weird as him and I just don't want to admit it, but as weird as he is, I could say I definitely relate
to
his...
I think he's weirder than you, but that's just my opinion. I think he's pretty damn weird, but go ahead.
I appreciate it. I need that these days. He is the most compelling thinker of all of them. His philosophy is much more well-defined and fleshed out. He's just a more interesting figure, and I think that's why so many people on the right gravitate towards his way of thinking. And even if they're extremely, I talk to people, influencers, people, I'm not going to name names, but people who you will see shilling for AI a lot publicly, who are actually quite deeply uncomfortable with the implications of AI, just the immediate social impacts and the long-term sort of existential things. But that culture kind of around Thiel and the Thiel Bucks, created a space where basically right-wing, to put it in a generic fashion, right-wing transhumanism could flourish. And it's complicated, but yeah.
Well, I think opposition to Palantir is an opportunity for left-right convergence. I was talking, my daughters are like to the left of me, which some people would say is quite an accomplishment. But in any event, they are, and I was talking to one of them and Palantir came up and, I didn't think of Palantir as something that was super widely known, although its profile has certainly gotten higher only in the last couple of years. But I said, "Oh, so you and your friends know about Palantir?" And she's like, "Yeah, yeah, we hate Palantir." And I'm like, "Good, you're off to a good start." So, you know, maybe there's a chance for.
You know, another element. I guess I don't focus on this much, but when they went public, I've had people rub it in my face that, "Oh, yeah, thanks for telling me about Palantir. I got in at the ground floor, and now I'm rich."
And you said that wasn't my plan.
Yeah, blood money.
You know, it's funny. So Palantir, you know, when I ask you about opposition to AI or skepticism about it within MAGA, and you started talking about COVID, it's not where I expected you to go. But then I saw that, you know, you're partly, I think, talking about issues of centralization of power. Of course, there was a lot of concern on the right, especially the MAGA right, during COVID, people were using it as an opportunity to amass centralized power, to control people, and so on. It is certainly the case that AI has. I mean, we haven't even talked quite explicitly yet about the capacity for surveillance, which is extensive. I mean, it can be used very potently. And, you know, and let me tell you, one thing that worries me about AI is that I think, as I said, it's going to have a dislocating, destabilizing effect. And the faster we go, the more that there's going to be. And then disorder is an opportunity for people who want to centralize power and abuse it, right? I mean, it's so funny that, you know, so many of these people, that some of the accelerationists are libertarians, because, like, I'm trying to tell them, I mean, if we go full speed ahead on AI and there's nothing to slow it down, I think we are increasing the chances that we wind up living in an authoritarian country, because AI provides both the excuse in its destabilizing effects and the tools, right, of control. So, yeah. But anyway,
1,000%.
Go ahead.
1,000%. And that's I don't know if I emphasize that or not, but that is, again, among the, to the extent I'm speaking for MAGA, and maybe not the best person to do so, but I do have a sense of that temperature. And that's one of the biggest fears and one of the biggest concerns and one of the most valid. Because we already have sensors everywhere, right? I mean, I'm talking into one right now. It's going over surveilled communications, and the deeper that gets and the more people are enticed to put their lives first, it was, you know, the Google search and the digitized kind of smartphone connections with other people, but now, like, OpenAI, they have all of your inputs, right? Every time you ask you prompt an AI, it's getting it, and people are putting deeper and deeper, more and more personal things into it. The surveillance and then the resulting manipulation, if you can monitor a society and take the temperature of it, and every political organization and corporation, for the most part, is doing something like this. If you can monitor and take the temperature of the sentiment of the population and do so in real time, your ability to manipulate them is massive, massive. And we see that all the time. I'm amazed it's not more effective, to be honest.
Yeah. So I would think that, in a way, if you and I both worry about the kind of just AI developing at a headlong pace. And I think you may say you're worried about it developing at any pace, and you'd like to stop it. But if we could focus for now on, I mean, I'm not sure I'd be against stopping it. I just don't think it's realistically conceivable. So I'm thinking about other things. It could turn out that the world would be better if you didn't stop it. I don't know. I mean, it does have a lot of upside. I'm agnostic, but I think we agree that there's a velocity of advance that is very dangerous. Yeah. I would think that I, as somebody on the left, have an easier time suggesting things to do about that than you do, in a way, because, like, I'm just, you know, let's how about some government regulation? Although I will say, one thing you could say, and I would agree with you, is, how about we not subsidize it? by paying for these, like, by the government, going out of its way to either subsidize or otherwise facilitate the construction of these massive power centers. I mean, that's something where on the right you can say, you know, you're just being completely ideologically consistent. But what about this issue of regulation? Now, interestingly, Marjorie Taylor Greene, who I think of as, you know, very, very MAGA-ish, she came out against. Yeah. Okay. Well, there you go. I'll take your word for that. But you know, this provision that was snuck into this legislation about banning for 10 years any regulation of AI by any state, any of the 50 states, she came out against that. And, you know, I kind of acknowledge that regulation is tricky. It's hard to get it right. But at a minimum, I wish people would quit saying, you know, if somebody proposed a regulation and they want to say, look, it's not going to work, or it's going to have this bad byproduct, fine, let's talk about that. But if they say the bad byproduct it has is like slowing down AI advance, I'm like, no, that's a feature, not a bug. I mean, that is not a valid reason to oppose a regulation. And so maybe, but anyway, what's your reaction to, like, how does somebody who comes from a part of the ideological spectrum that historically is very skeptical of regulation, how do you slow something like this down?
Well, just to distinguish myself from the background, I am not really politically aligned with any, there's no label other than irresponsible that you could put on me. I'm kind of half joking there, but certainly I'm not, I've never really been a very political person. I've always been skeptical of the ability of government and politics to make life a whole lot better for people. I'm not a libertarian or anything like that. I've never really identified as any of it, but and I'm a union guy, right? So it's very important. So anyway, the 10-year moratorium, the war room was a central force. Steve, especially, was a central force in scrapping that. I've been at the war room now, like I say, for like 4 years and 3 months, 4 months. I almost never discussed politics. I just don't have much use for it. Politics, for the most part, is a smokescreen of lies and backstabbing and social climbing and all that. But it is part of the adult world, and you do have to deal with it. It was not until Trump partnered with Elon Musk that I became vocal about politics and the importance of it, and then really intensified with the Stargate project announcement on the second day of the administration. Then my first real political advocacy ever in my life that I can think of, other than just like, don't surveil us and put stuff up our butts, like as if we were abductees and you were aliens.
That's a good campaign slogan, by the way. Should you ever run for office? I like that. It's a slightly long as a bumper sticker, but don't surveil us or put stuff up our butts. It's got a certain rhythm.
And you would definitely need like an alien with a, you know, in a
you
a
want the
UFO
alien image for sure.
So, but the moratorium is the first thing I ever really spoke out on. I gave kind of speech into the GOP in Dallas. I on the war room spoke out against it. Steve spoke out against it. We allied with other people who were speaking out against it. A good friend of mine, Sean Penn, was really an essential part of connecting me to a lot of the organizations that I'm now talking to that are against that sort of thing. So, and it also gave me the first taste of blood for the for a political win. Because a lot of people think that the political system or the agendas of the political system are kind of set in stone. You're not going to do anything about it. Well, to whatever effect it will have downstream, we did. We had a massive impact. Because if you did do that, now the enforcement of the moratorium would simply be to deny broadband and other infrastructure funds to the states who regulated AI in the ways that the federal government didn't want. It wasn't like they'd be sending jackbooted thugs to arrest the mayor and take him and throw him off a bridge or whatever. But it still would have a chilling effect on sane regulation. And you look at people point to California as the reason, like, this is why we can't have any state determining policy for everyone. I look at the 18 laws that are specifically directed at AI and the proposed 19th for holding AI companies accountable for the harms that they cause. I think they're quite reasonable. The more overarching regulation, the big bill in Texas that, you know, protect constitutional rights, forbid using AI for social behavioral manipulation, things like this, very reasonable. The recent law in Illinois, you can't promote an AI therapist as a certified clinical psychologist or use that as a clinical psychologist and give it to people. Completely reasonable. And I, you know, Pritzker and basically all of Illinois politics, I'm just like, God, you know, these people are just atrocious. But, you know, they're right on that. Even if their motives are not correct, they're correct. So, yeah, I think that state level regulation is actually better than, you know, overarching federal regulation, because so many different states are going to have so many different approaches to this. Yeah. So I guess what I'm saying is that, no, I don't take at all a libertarian stance on this. I don't think that the state's going to be able to protect you. I think most of what will protect human beings from the worst aspects of artificial intelligence is going to be a matter of choice. And it's especially going to be a matter of collective choice in communal groups. But I think that at any opportunity you have to impact the institutions around you, schools, you know, we're not going to have AI teachers everywhere. Corporations, we're not going to make everybody defer to AI. The government, we're not going to flood the government with bots that write people's already useless memos for them. I think any impact people can have on those institutions, the better we are, the better off we are. You know,
mm-hmm. Let me ask you about one other possible tension between skepticism about AI and not necessarily your own ideological position. I don't know what it is on this, certainly I would say the position of much of MAGA and the war room specifically, which is China. So historically, I've heard a number of people on the War Room podcast depict China as the Chinese regime as adversary, if not enemy, if not even existential threat. I don't know. And this is something that they have in common with some of the people pushing for rapid AI advance. As you know, a big talking point of the Sam Altmans of the world who want to avoid government regulation and get government subsidies is to say, if we don't move fast, China's going to beat us. And that has more traction in an environment where there's a lot of fear of China than an environment where there's not. So, I mean, that's the first thing I'd ask about. And then I'll leave it at that for now. And then do part two later. What do you say about that?
It's complicated, but, and I'm not definitely not, Steve is as hawkish as you can get on China, sanctioned by the CCP, right? He's as hawkish as it comes. So leaving that aside, for me, I do think that restricting the chip exports to China is a very, very good idea for a lot of reasons. I think that the concession to give them the H-20s was a bad idea for a lot of different reasons, but in general, the problem, to the extent that we can all agree that AI is a potential problem, and I would say it's just a problem. It's a problem that was born out of America and Western culture for sure. You know, the Brits, Turing, people like that, with the heart of it. But Silicon Valley is the crucible of artificial intelligence. They've driven all of this forward. American interests have driven this forward. American frontier tech companies, you know, all the frontier AI companies, OpenAI, Anthropic, XAI, Google, I guess if you want to call Meta a frontier company, all of these companies, they are American. They are way ahead of the Chinese. To the extent the Chinese have kept up in artificial intelligence, it's largely been due to willing technology transfer, Tesla, Apple, others, and then also transfer from students being allowed in the U.S. and IP theft, right? So the U.S. is responsible for this problem. And I think that using China as a scapegoat, and I'm by the way, I'm not pro-China, or at least not pro-CCP, I should say. I love the Chinese and the Chinese culture. But yeah, I think that the excuse, like holding China up as a rationale for accelerationism, is very disingenuous, because the Chinese are only racing to keep up with us. Maybe they would have done it on their own. They actually, Chinese computer scientists are much more cautious in general about the possibility of, say, artificial general intelligence or super intelligence. It's often been said the Chinese don't want to be ruled by AI, right? They want the Communist Party to rule China. So yeah, I don't buy it, I guess is what I'm saying. And to the extent that China is a rationale for accelerating, it's the fault of the people pushing for acceleration, by and large. It leaves us in a real problem. I also don't think that it's a good rationale for a lot of the applications of AI. Are you going to tell me that if Americans don't give every student an AI tutor, or if you don't have a corporate culture where everybody just basically talks to AIs and uses AI to write their emails, that China's going to take over the world? That doesn't make any sense whatsoever. The only place I think where that makes sense is in a national security, from a national security standpoint. Because if AI does live up to its promise of determining geopolitical power militarily, then yes, okay, fine. But again, what's the end point, right? What's the telos of all this? You're ultimately talking about mutually assured destruction at the under the control of autonomous systems, right? I mean, that's the natural end result. If AI keeps getting better and better and better and better, and the international or the geopolitical rivalry keeps increasing, the end point of that is multiple nations with nuclear weapons that are largely or entirely controlled by autonomous minds, right? Or non-human minds, lethal autonomous weaponry. And is that where we want to go? I'm not making much of a point here other than to say that it's a problem, and it's a problem that stems from the U.S. And if the rubber hits the road with massive drone swarms, or fully autonomous fleets of ships, or fully autonomous intercontinental ballistic missiles with nuclear tips, it's just basically you're creating a hellscape for no good reason, in my mind.
Yeah, I mean, my own view is, in various ways, intense AI competition between the U.S. and China could lead to such scary things that maybe a little rapprochement would be good for both of us. Maybe I'll explore that in the next part of our conversation. Now, as you know, and as regular listeners know, what we generally do is talk for a pretty long time in public like this, and then we go into what we call overtime, which is available to paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter, which we encourage people to become. Helps keep us going. And there's a link in the show notes that'll do that, that can take you to a point where you can become a member. And for that matter, you can go to the Non-Zero website and click on this, the post for this podcast. And there's a way to do that there, too. Now, Joe, you've been generous enough to say you'll stick around and keep talking for a while. Before we go into overtime, I want to give you a chance to say anything you want to say by way of qualifying anything you said earlier, or summing up, or self-promotion. Do you have a website aside from the book? You've got the book Dark Aeon, but you also have a web, JoeBot or something?
Yeah. JoeBot.xyz. It's going to start filling up again soon. It's been kind of slow in the last few months. I've been working a lot, but yeah, JoeBot.xyz has a lot of my writings, and there's also a link to signed copies of the book if you're interested. And the book itself is a book of, you could say, technological mythology, but it was published 2 years ago, and I must say that the last 2 years have vindicated many of the observations that I made. Not that they're all original to me, but yeah, I hope your listeners would enjoy it. If you love Robert Wright's books, you'll like mine.
Okay, I'll go with that. All right, so we're heading into overtime. Thanks everybody who is who has followed us this far. Hope you'll join us in overtime, and here we go.